Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Freddie.
Welcome back, everybody. I hope you're all enjoying your summer. A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Kieran Doherty. Without him, we just wouldn't sound as good as we like to think we do. And supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Carolyn Nikolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for a wonderful effort. And a big shout out to all our listeners, particularly in the Toronto area. And a big shout out to Carrie. Really nice speaking to you the other day. So let's have a recap from our previous podcast. We had Trevor Jacobs with us, correct? He was speaking to us and educating us about HVAC systems. Bernie?
Yeah, he did a great job. I learned a couple of really interesting things.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a wonderful opportunity for our listeners to learn all about all these new and wonderful building mechanical and envelopes that are available to us. You've got me. So anything in the mailbag today, Bernie?
Oh, Freddie, yes, there is. We have something from Mario. He received something from his bank today about a mortgage commitment. And most of the conditions are pretty easy for him to understand. But he noted the borrower must maintain a 1.2:1 debt service ratio. What on earth is a debt service ratio?
First of all, thank you for your question, Mario. I take it this must be an income property or investment property, because normally we wouldn't have reference in a mortgage commitment to a debt service ratio or otherwise, or on a residential mortgage. I totally understand your confusion. Between GDS, TDS, and loan to value ratios, it can be and it can get a little confusing at times. Simply put, a debt service ratio is calculated by dividing your net operating income, that portion of your cash flow available to debt service. So remember, you've got your gross income, and from that, you subtract, in very, very simple terms, the related expenses to arrive at your net operating income, and dividing that amount by the required or stated ratio. It has the effect of reducing the available amount of money that a financial institution will use to calculate what your maximum debt or mortgage will or would be. In the example you've provided, the financial institution is reducing the amount of cash flow by 20%. If it was a 1.3:1 debt service ratio, it would be 30%. But without, if you're not mathematically inclined, all you need to do is divide your net operating income by 1.2. And only then, after calculating that amount, do they determine the maximum amount of money they are prepared to lend you. I hope that clears it up. Anything else, Bernie?
Question from Ruby. She's looking for an explanation between the difference between amortization period and term.
Thank you, Ruby, for the question. Great question. We get asked it a great deal of time, because to a lot of people who only have a residential mortgage and only renew it maybe once every 5 years or so, the terms can be confusing. So I'm going to try to explain it in really, really simple terms. The amortization period is the length of time in years. For most of our listeners, it's going to be years that it takes to pay off the principal portion of a loan or mortgage in full. Typically 20, 25, 30 years. I think you're going to see in some markets that being increased to 40 years. So that's the total period of time you have, or the loan is amortized into principal and interest payments, that it would take if you didn't take advantage of any prepayment privileges, it would take to pay the loan off. The term can be any period of time. It can be a matter of months or 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, 25 years that the interest rate is fixed. So right now, for instance, you can get, now there's been a recent rate increase here. So let's say you may be able to get short-term money a year or maybe 6 months or less for 2.25%, 2.5% here in Canada. But generally, if you want something longer, it's going to be 3.75%, 4.25%, which sounds horrifically high considering we had such an extended period of low interest payments. So, for instance, there are some markets where a mortgage loan with an amortization period of 25 years can also have a term of 25 years. That used to be the case back in the 50s, 60s, where you would get a mortgage and the mortgage was at 3%, and it was 3% during the entire amortization period of the loan. So you paid one payment during the entire period of time you had that mortgage until the home was paid for. May have seemed high at the time, but as time proves, that became ridiculously low as time marched on. So again, what that would mean in general terms is that you would pay the same payment every month for the entire 25-year period. Most terms, of course, are for somewhat less than the amortization period, which means that at the end of the term, the interest rate is up for renegotiation. And that can be really troubling if you purchased a home and qualified for a mortgage at a lower interest rate. There's a number of people right now that qualified at 1.85, 1.99%, 2.25%, 2.5%, and just got in under the GDS and TDS ratio, as we spoke about before. Now, all of a sudden, when their mortgage comes up for renewal, those ratios may not hold true any longer. What may end up happening is that the rate may go up to maybe 3 percentage points. And as a consequence, very early on in a mortgage period, your payments are going to go up by a substantial amount, could be 50%. It's less the case when you're well into your mortgage, if you have less than maybe 10 years left, because there are options available to you. What you can do is, and I see this and come across this, I won't say often, but fairly regularly, where what we do is we'll increase the amortization period again. So you may have 10 years, but the principal balance is far less than what it was when you started, you know, 25 years or 15 years prior, sorry. So what we do is we increase the amortization period again to get that payment down below a certain threshold. If you need any more information, send me an email. I'll be really, really happy to walk you through the process once again.
Fred, thank you. So folks, if you have any questions, send your queries to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. Of course, Freddie, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities, which is a perfect lead-in to...
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
So, Bernie, there's been an incredible amount going on in the news, both north and south of the border. But I want to speak to one particular point. The title of the two articles I'm referencing are Roommates, Multi-Generational Homes Rising Amid Increasing Costs and Immigration, according to the recent census information that was just published. That headline by the Canadian Press. The second article I'd like to reference says roommate households, the fastest growing living arrangement in Canada, census shows. This particular article was written by Victoria Gibson, who's the affordable housing reporter, and Ben Cohen, who's a staff reporter with the, I believe, Toronto Star. So both these articles reference the latest census information. And the point that I'm trying to make is that it seems like it's all doom and gloom. But the reality is that the idea that younger people are having to stay in their homes longer is not unique. If you were to study housing or family situations in other parts of the world, particularly the EU, the Middle East, you name it, it's not the least bit unusual for young people to stay with their families until they're in their 20s, 30s, until they're married anyways. In a lot of cultures, it wouldn't even be thought of that a young person would leave the family until they left the family to start their own household. So I want to read you something just that really kind of puts things in the right perspective. And I apologize to some of our listeners because this statistic really relates to the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area. As of April 2022, the average home in the Greater Toronto Area cost $1.25 million, meaning a household would need to earn more than $220,000 per year to afford it, assuming that they had already saved the more than $250,000 for a 20% down payment. Now, that's from the Toronto Star's Clary Feinstein. 6 months earlier, the income required to buy a typical home was hovering just above $200,000 a year. So you can see how just a little blip can really, really change the affordability picture for a lot of young people and a lot of families. Because I don't know too many young people that are making $220,000 plus a year and who have $250,000 in the bank. Do you, Bernie?
No, not really.
To put things in another perspective, across, again, this speaks to the GTA area, across the Toronto area, the average one-bedroom listed on rentals.ca in June was $2,192 per month. For a unit at that price to be considered affordable or cost less than the 30% of pre-tax income, now to remember, that relates back to the question that we had earlier during the podcast, a household would need to make more than $87,000 per year. So how many kids get out of university or college and immediately step into an $87,000 a year job? Not too many, I'd suggest. Okay. So this new data, the article goes on to state, paints a picture of a housing market that doesn't reflect what people really need, specifically highlighting a lack of affordable housing options. Now, as we're so fond of saying, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
Great, Bernie. So what do you think the opportunity is here? You know, yes, young people need to stay in their homes longer. Yes, it's not becoming any more affordable for young people to go out and purchase a home. But I'm going to suggest to you that it's not every place that you go to where young people can either afford or entitled to own a home. Entitlement may not be the right term, but the point that I'm trying to make is that homes in many parts of the world remain generational. The home that your grandparents maybe bought or built or lived in all their entire lives and that you were brought up in as a child could be yours now. You could be bringing up your family in it. That's not unusual. And that's the way it is in many parts of the world. And in part, that's driven because of affordability. In other parts of the world, as I mentioned earlier during the show, it's not unusual to have an extended period as far as an amortization period is concerned, not 20, 25 years, which is, you know, kind of considered the norm here in North America, but for 30, 40 years. In other cultures, it's not just the home, whether you're renting or whether you own your home, it has to do with taking care of your parents, taking care of your grandparents. It's more of a cultural difference. And I think what you're seeing with the increase of immigration here north of the border in Canada, I think what you're seeing is, and these statistics from this most recent census really kind of proved the point. Young people are staying in their homes longer. There's more multi-generational households today than there were. And what this creates is a great opportunity for people who own single-family homes to create another living unit in their homes. And we've been going and talking about this for months and months for shows and shows. You know, any home, when asked whether you should buy a home or whether you should buy an income property, I've always said do both. So now I'm speaking to an older generation and I'm saying, this is a great opportunity for you to supplement your income and create a living unit, either for your own kids or for another individual. Like this, again, there's a problem, but there's a solution, and it's a solution that can benefit all. And I think regardless of all the government programs and all the money you throw at the problem, it's going to be the small property owner and landlord that really takes a serious bite out of this affordable housing situation. Now, right now, we're being forced economically. You know, people just can't afford it, so they need a place to live. So what does this mean? Maybe less pressure on the housing market, but there's definitely going to be an increase of need and want for rental accommodation. And when that doesn't exist, the very real option available to most is to move in with their parents. And that's not a step backwards. That's the reality in the better part of the world. I think we just need to kind of adjust our way of thinking. It's very quickly becoming that real estate or home ownership isn't something that we can all necessarily afford. It's become quite commonplace now with certain programs with nominal amount of monies down. But it used to be not that long ago, you know, I'm going to suggest to you, you know, 35, 40, 50 years ago, that you didn't even think about buying a home unless you had 25% down. And I know it sounds like a stupid amount of money in today's world, and it is, but everything needs to be relative. I'm talking about 25% down on a $30,000 purchase, which may be an average home cost back in the 1960s. I mean, $7,500. It seems like nothing. Seems like your Visa bill from last month. But the reality is most people were making maybe $3,000 a year, maybe $3,500, maybe $4,000 a year. So everything's relative. So you can't, if you're going to compare it, compare what the income potential was for a recent graduate or for a professional at the time. But don't try to compare the amounts of down payment then versus today without taking the other considerations into effect. So at the end of the day, I'm saying, well, it may be all doom and gloom and maybe not everybody can afford a home right now, but there's serious opportunity here for investors to get into the market and to increase the supply of rental accommodation. How many times, Bernie, over the past couple of months have we spoken specifically about that, about how different municipalities across North America, we even spoke of Germany at one point in time, have introduced different type of housing initiatives for people just to try to resolve this particular issue. And here it is. Now the census points to exactly what it is we need. I think you'd have to be a blind man not to see the writing on the wall. So anyways, that's all I have to say about that topic today. Anyways, let's move on. Listeners, we have a real treat for you today. We are pleased to have as our guest, Sandra Lee Lester, who holds quite a number of designations, and I hope I get this right. She holds a BTEC in Architectural Science, an MCOD, an ARIDO, IDC, CPHD, a CSBA, is LEED certified, also holds an AP, a BD&C, and an HLC3. Sandra is also the CEO and Director of Sustainable Building Consulting at AffectingChange.com. Sandra got her Bachelor of Technology in Architectural Science from Toronto Metropolitan University and her Master's in Organizational Development with a Certificate in Change Management from Schulich School of Business at York University. She is a Certified Passive House Designer, Certified Sustainable Building Advisor, and LEED Accredited Professional with a specialty in building design and construction. Sandra not only takes a special interest in how we use building retrofits to enable families and tenants to achieve higher levels of overall health and well-being through better building design, but is also a qualified personal trainer, Zumba instructor, Strong Nation instructor, and Czech Level 3 holistic lifestyle coach. Sandra was a project manager for the Mao unit upgrade that was awarded a low carbon economy fund Champion Street and authored the prototype RFP contract for the Atmospheric Fund's Tower Renewal Project that won a prestigious Clean 50 Top Project Award in 2021. Sandra is a sought-after post-secondary educator and has taught at several universities in Australia and Canada and is currently a part-time professor teaching a capstone course on passive building design in the Faculty of Applied Sciences and Technology at Humber Advanced Institute of Technology and Advanced Learning. Wow, what a mouthful. Welcome to the show, Sandra.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
That is a very, very impressive resume. I am just thrilled to have you as a guest. So let's get right into this. Here's a loaded question. What is a net zero transition plan?
So a net zero transition plan would be a measuring of your energy usage and resultant carbon footprint on either a property or a portfolio of properties. And then looking at what can be done to decrease the loads for heating and cooling, firstly, and then adding renewables to get to net zero. So net zero is an equation of one component plus another, and the net is zero between them. It's cheaper to reduce the loads first and then add renewables to get to that net zero.
It's a really interesting approach. It leads me to my next question. The thing that's always in the back of my mind and in the back of a number of people I've had this discussion with before, can a net zero transition plan be both practical and effective with an existing building versus a new build?
Absolutely. I'm working on a design of a few retrofits for commercial properties right now. And you have to look at the property and what the strengths and weaknesses of that property are and figure out how is that property performing right now. So I heard that your listeners, there's a lot of listeners in Florida. So I looked up some benchmarks for Florida. So the average site energy use intensity, and that's a good score to look at. Don't look at your total energy use, but how you use energy on a square foot basis per year. That's what energy use intensity talks about. So like that density of energy used in that property. So the average site energy use intensity for the commercial sector in Florida is 46.4 kilobtus per square foot per year. Let me translate that over into a metric version for us Canadians. That works out to be about 147.1 kilowatt hours per meter squared per year. And all of that on-site energy that's burnt as fossil fuels, that also gets converted over to kilowatt hours. So it's still that energy use intensity that you want to look at. Okay, that is 90% higher than a new construction built to passive house standards.
Really?
Yeah. So if you were to design that commercial building to passive house standards, instead of 147.1, you would have hit an energy use intensity score of 15 kilowatt hours per meter squared per year.
Wow, that much of a difference.
Yeah. And then let's look at the overall for a passive house certified retrofit, which is called an Enerfit retrofit. And if you take the 147.1 and you minus the 30 kilowatt hours per meter squared per year, you get 117.1 kilowatt hours per meter squared per year. And you divide that by the average, 147.1. You get that number, 79%. That's what we're really seeing in the market is that properties are about 80% less efficient than they could be. 80%.
Wow, huge market. Absolutely an incredible market for your services.
But it's not meaningful yet. So when it comes to overall energy costs, they're not very high. So what we're seeing is a lot of adoption of retrofits in Europe where energy costs are higher. But I'm here to say that that is coming here to North America very soon. We've already seen our prices at the gas station go up, right? We've been living in this bubble of cheap energy for years. So it's time to take a look at not only what you're paying right now for utility costs, but also looking at the escalation costs for utilities going up. Fuel switching is going to be a big thing. Getting off of that fossil fuel energy and over to electricity is going to be a huge trend because electricity rates are not going to go up as fast as fossil fuels. What we've been doing is we've been putting off and deferring our payments for that fossil fuel pollution into the future for decades now, and it's going to come back to haunt us. So there's over 2,000 lawsuits in the courts right now worldwide about climate change. And we're seeing a lot of governments that are controlled by corporations. They have huge lobby groups, so they're not following through on their climate commitments. But that's going to change because the courts are going to start ruling that it is against the Constitution to not take responsibility for climate change. What does that mean to the average property owner? Your average cost of carbon is going to go from zero, which is embedded right now, into the $300, $400 per ton range within 20 years. It could be faster. It just depends on the level, like how quickly these things go through the courts and what regulations are adopted. We're already seeing regulations in the states that are held up by Governor Representative Manchin. Those regulations in the United States would reduce the emissions of the United States by 50% by 2030. And how do they do that? Probably with a carbon tax that gets downstreamed to the property owner, which gets downstreamed to either the tenant or the rental property or someone who's paying utility costs. So this is the wave that's coming. And you might not see, you know, a good return on an investment if you're using today's utility rates. But if you start looking at future costs of utilities, all of a sudden that business case for retrofits becomes crystal clear.
Can you explain the concept between carbon taxes and how they are supposed to function and work?
The carbon tax market was a lot more fair to the everyday person, right? Because we don't know when that person is pulling up to the gas pump, whether they make $25 an hour or whether they make 15, right? They're taxed at the same rate for that gas. The way that we had the carbon tax market in Ontario working was that we were looking at the biggest polluters in the province. If they were above a certain threshold, they had to pay a high tax for carbon. And then that threshold was going to reduce over time. And what that money did was it got shifted over to organizations, companies that are doing retrofit work or doing energy efficiency work that wouldn't have otherwise been done. So in the carbon market and in carbon offsets, there's this concept of additionality. And additionality is key when you look at carbon, okay? So we have our business as usual scenario. And then when we inject money into a situation, somebody will do something that they otherwise would not have done. My clients will do a retrofit if they get a grant or if they get a loan. And then there will be carbon associated carbon savings that result from that action. And the additionality has to be permanent. So what we're seeing right now at our gas pumps is that this carbon tax is being applied all the way down to basically everyone that owns a car or anyone that even goes on public transit with gas fueled. You know, I've seen the prices for bus fares go up, right? Like I haven't owned a car for 14 years, right? So I'm not going to the gas pump, but I see other people that do it. It's really an unfair way to transfer money into action that will promote additionality and promote and make people do things that will save carbon. I really liked the Ontario system that was already set up with the carbon market. I thought that that was forward thinking. Projects were getting done. I know the building environment. And because of that system that was set up, a lot of retrofit work got done on Ontario college campuses. And we own those campuses. So the Ontario college system is an asset that's owned by the people of Ontario. So investing money into retrofits just means that we're investing into something that has a good payback because they're paying a lot less utility costs for that as well. I don't like the system that's set up, but it was something that they could implement using regulations, and it's what we have for the moment.
Thank you so much for that explanation. I've got a much better grasp on the entire concept behind a carbon tax. And I'm glad we kind of agree, at least on the point that it's not the ideal system. And I don't think it targets the right. What is the Paris Agreement? And why is it so important to property owners and developers alike?
That's a non-binding agreement between countries of the world that have signed on. And that what they've said is that they commit to reducing their carbon footprint by a certain time over certain levels. And I think it was a 1990 benchmark. You know, I'm not one of those people that spouts off stats off the top of my head. But what I like to do is describe these types of things that people see in the news into their everyday life. So what the Paris Agreement means is that there's going to be varying levels of change in the regulatory political environment to try and make sure that their Paris climate commitments happen.
So when it comes to the manufacture of solar panels, which is my next question, have solar options really become affordable and reliable enough that they should be considered for all building applications, both new build and existing?
On a worldwide basis, it's cheaper to produce electricity with solar than it is with coal or any other product right now. That's a worldwide average. What we're seeing in the developing world is that they're skipping over the steps that we took for energy production during the Industrial Revolution, and they're going straight to solar. Now, it depends on the exact region that you're in and municipality as to what incentives you'll be able to tap into. But let's just say we always do a solar, photovoltaic, and renewable energy feasibility study for every project that we're on. You just don't know until you run the numbers.
So, got a question here for air, using ground source air pumps or just straight air for commercial or multi-residential purposes. Are there efficiencies to be had, or are they too similar in comparison?
The actual heat pump mechanism is going to be about the same, but the source of the heat is going to be different. So when you're looking at a ground source heat pump, the loop is usually a glycol loop. It's liquid, and it can be a little bit denser than water. Water is 10,000 times more dense than air and can hold a lot more heat, probably about four times more heat. So your ground source heat pump is going to be a lot more efficient overall, not four times more efficient, but still more efficient. What I'm seeing, though, is that the capital cost for ground source heat pumps are prohibitive. I was talking to a client of mine that is considering a ground source heat pump, and he said, I just won't do it because they had somebody come over and they figured out the number of wells they were going to have to drill. It was 2 to 3 boreholes, 200 to 300 foot boreholes each. So going down into the ground 200 to 300 feet. And it was going to be $15,000 per borehole. So we're looking at $30,000 to $45,000 for a ground source heat pump. And it's not going to be that costly to do an air source heat pump. If any of your listeners are in the know about a cold climate air to water source heat pump, then please reach out to me and let me know if you know something that's reliable, because I'm looking for some for another project. But yeah, that's the big sticking point with geothermal. Now, a lot of these, or it's called geothermal here, but it's really ground source heat pump systems. A lot of these providers actually offer financing now, and it's worth taking a look at in terms of the financing. Yeah.
So if I'm going to invest in some real estate, what are some of the things I should look at to increase efficiencies existing that aren't costly?
I would say that we used to call it weatherization in the 70s. So remember when the oil prices were really high with OPEC, a bunch of weatherization programs were brought out in North America to deal with the high energy prices. And what they did is, you know, they would blow insulation to the attic. They would do a blower door test and figure out what parts of the building are leaking. They would seal up windows during the winter, like even putting one of those plastic air seals on your window in the winter that you make tight with the hairdryer makes a huge difference. But I would say air tightness is the biggest bang for your buck. It's usually the low hanging fruit. And then, you know, make sure you're changing your furnace filter regularly. A lot of people don't think that's important, but generally on forced air furnaces, the fan is about 8% efficient. And when you're making that fan work harder, you're just wasting money. And MERV 16 filters are good for filtering out aerosolized particles. They remove about 95% of COVID particles. They will help with wildfire smoke if you're in areas that are prone to that. So I always recommend that to my clients. Those are two easy things. And then when you're doing the air tightness, just make sure that you're not wrapping your some plastic, because you really do need that ventilation to happen. If you don't already have exhaust fans in your bathroom, put it in. If you don't have exhaust fans in your kitchen, put them in. Like, you're just allowing humidity to build up. That moisture is going to go somewhere, and you don't want it ending up in your walls and creating that mold. And stay away from your coveted natural gas appliances. A lot of people have on their wish list a natural gas stove, because they're very highly sensitive to the temperature level when you're cooking. They're very responsive, right? And I put in a gas stove. I'll never make that mistake again, because they really put a lot of toxic chemicals into your airspace. So stay away from those.
Really great points. And on that note, Sandra, thank you. This has been incredibly informative. There's so much information there. I think a lot of our listeners will be pressing the replay button on this one. Thank you for being our guest today. It was an absolute pleasure having you. And I'm sure our listeners will have all sorts of questions for you. What's the best way for them to reach you?
Yeah, just go to my website. There's contact information there. www.affectingchange.com. So affectingchange.com. And my current contact information is there if you go there.
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
The word of the day is, Bernie, what's the word today?
Sealed.
Okay, so you've probably seen the word sealed or signed under seal, or even just an odd looking circular print next to a signature line on a legal document of some sort. They're on just about everything, you know, leases, contractual agreements. They all mean the same thing. The word sealed or seal or the sealed insignia is meant to add more strength to the signature. Basic contract law states that some sort of consideration must be given in order for a contract to be binding. And consideration can take a number of different forms. The word seal or the insignia takes the place of a more traditional form of consideration, such as cash. You'll sometimes see in a movie or a situation where someone will, after signing a considerable contract, will take a dollar bill out of their pocket and pass it over the table to, you know, the other signatory. That actually forms a binding contract because you've passed some form of consideration, because the law doesn't differentiate whether that consideration is you signing under a sealed print or whether it's actually a $1 bill. But in order for a contract to be legally binding, there must be some form of consideration passed between the parties. And that's all it is. So it's as simple as that. Not any more complicated. So next time you sign a formal document, legal or otherwise, you know exactly what you're doing. So thank you. Thank you for that. All right. Awesome. So anything else to add, Bernie?
Again, Sandra, it's been extremely enlightening. It comes back down to, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities. I think we should adapt a new moniker, save farmland, build rental accommodation.
Nice.
There we go. Beautiful. So thank you, listeners.
I'll tweet that out when I tweet the link.
You should do that. Absolutely. Please do. That would be absolutely great. And I think that's what we're going to use as our headliner too. You know, save farmland, build rental accommodation or rental units or whatever the case may be. Listeners, thank you so very, very much. I hope that you've found this podcast informative. Please, if you have any questions, send them to us and we'll do our best to get them on the air. And you can always reach out at most any time with your questions about today's podcast or possibly even one of the last that we've done. So again, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities. If you're going to send in an email, the address is info@gentryres.com, info@gentryres.com.
Take care. Till next time.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.